Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. You ain't gonna be in there. But 51% of your prisoners will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Black won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. And I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for a lead. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations, who got the money? That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control, and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor, and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor, that is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries, and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk only control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisoners in the United States are black people. You know you only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March, who cares? Marching, they never changed anything.
I got in a huge tax situation in 2008 because my divorce was in 2005 and my accountant had gotten in cahoots, and next thing you know, my accountant died and a girl that worked for him called my lawyer and said, "We have a problem." She had found on the floor all my tax forms for 7 years, signed and with the checks stapled to them. So I'm thinking, I've signed and I've stapled the checks. Well, they were cashing the checks, keeping the money, and not turning in the tax form. They took the money out of the account that matched the exact, because I wasn't watching it.
So like, you could just see $100,000, $600,000,
deducted. So I'm thinking it's the check. Little did I know, it was some people taking the money out.
For 7 years?
For 7 years.
How much money did that?
I ended up owing $22 million.
Wow.
$22 million with the penalties. So now, listen to me, man. Me and my wife in 2008, I get the call. And the way I found out was, my lawyer called me and said, hey, man, we got a problem. You haven't paid taxes in 7 years. I said, man, what are you talking about? I paid taxes. I've been writing the checks and all this here. Oh, man. He said, this woman found your taxes in your accountant's office on the floor. Every tax check I had written and every was stapled together for 7 years, quarterly taxes, all of it. So he said, man, that's tax evasion. You can go to prison. And I said, what are we going to do? So he said, hold on, man, let me get some lawyers. So he called up some tax accountants out of Chicago. These boys was the best. And they set me down and they said, man, we got a major problem. He said, I got a friend working at the IRS. Let me take the first year. We took the first year and we sent it in. And he said, man, well, this is an old tax return. He said, man, we got a problem. He got more, but he didn't know it. And so we need a tax payment plan. So the tax payment plan was so astronomical that it was no way I could pay this. So the deal was, if you miss one payment, we come and seize all your assets and you go into jail. That was the deal. So the way I found out I was in real bad trouble was, my accountants, my former manager, lawyer, got on a conference call to discuss it. But they sent out an email with the conference call number to my assistant. But it wasn't supposed to go to me. She inadvertently gave it to me. I wasn't even supposed to be on the call. So when I logged in, they were already talking, and I just didn't announce myself. And I heard them say, nobody can live under this amount of stress. There's no way he can pay the back taxes, pay his current taxes, and his living expenses. And I heard a guy on the phone say, what are we going to do when he goes to jail? And I hung the phone up. I went upstairs. I said, Marjorie, Dawson, Marjorie, we got a problem. When I explained it to her, Marjorie started crying. She sat down and cried. My wife cried for 2 straight days. She said, Steve, what you going to do? I said, I'm going to go to work. I took every comedy gig in this country. I signed every contract. I went to work, man. I worked every single Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. I went to every venue, the Verizon, Staples Center, MCI, Phillips. I sold out the Fox. I went everywhere. I stayed on the radio, man. I'm coming, sold out. I never missed a payment. And for 4 years in a row, I was sending $650,000 a month to the government. Plus, I had to pay my current taxes.
New taxes.
I couldn't get behind on nothing. And I was living. So I was credit cards, running them up, paying them off. And finally, man, in 2012, I sold 49% of my radio company to iHeart. I got a check, man. I got me a check. And then, so I paid the government completely off to zero. And that was the first time, man, I could breathe. And then the pay-per-view, I said, let me get out of stand-up, because my wife said, Steve, you're finna be a major TV star. You're gonna have to stop telling the jokes you're telling, because you're gonna ruin your career. Because she saw the political correctness turning. And so she said, Steve, you can stop if you want to. I said, baby, I can't ever stop telling jokes. It's who I am. She said, well, okay, but you got to watch what you say. And all of my TV shows are sponsor-driven. The radio is sponsorship-driven. I said, man, let me get out of this, because I need time to go do more TV. And so I did one last comedy show, but I did it on pay-per-view. And little did I know, for $8, you could watch my last show. I had no idea how many people was going to tune in for that. I made a lot of money. It was the biggest single paycheck I ever made. And next thing you know, I was back. Now, learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said this man that went to heaven, and he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and it was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. He messed around. He saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he's here. He said, nah, I want to know what's in the door. He said, you sure you want to see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you're having is, when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it, because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on Not Meant to Be Way, because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go over on Pity Way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So, if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she's been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad a cat. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how.
So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he will come.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer at the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles, the kid no one would pick, was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Before I get started with this video, I just want to personally thank the brother Fred Hassan Powell of the Morale Facebook page for sharing this social political cartoon, which is currently displayed in this video. I always big up brothers who are artists like him, my man Will James, Alex K. Art, Chris Miller, and others, because their pictures speak volumes. They don't have to say one word because, as they say, a picture is worth a thousand words. In fact, I want y'all to take a good look at this picture, which shows a brother with his hat flipped to the back telling the bald-headed brother that he's hungry as fuck. When the brother attempts to hand him his own fishing rod so he can get some fish on his own, he gets verbally assaulted. No, nigga, I want some fish. Fuck out of here with that coon shit. Man, if you look closer, you'll see that the brother that says he's hungry got a fresh pair of Jordans on his feet. And once again, I want to thank you, Fred, for sharing that photo because it is a perfect warm-up for what I'm getting ready to bring up next. Look, last week, I had to stop past a gas station, and when I went in, I took a quick glance over to the newsstand, and I saw the Washington Post. The first thing that caught my eye was something that you normally don't see on the cover of a newspaper, which was a few straggling pants sagging brothers sitting on a stoop of a building outside. I didn't have the time to read the paper in the gas station because I had to fly, but I checked the article online when I got home, and I was just flabbergasted. I want you all to check it out for yourself in the description box. It is the December 9th edition of the Washington Post, And the front cover story is a look back at the riots which took place in Baltimore this past April following the death of Freddie Gray. The Post took the time to interview a few of the residents and get their personal take on how things have been and has any positive change come to the streets of Baltimore after the riots. And one of the brothers that they interviewed was a young man that was out there on the streets peddling drugs from time to time, and he stated that he ended up finding out shortly after the riots that there were a few storefront apartments that were up for sale and that they were only selling for just $5,000 a piece. He then said that when he ran the idea of getting together and investing in the neighborhood past several brothers that he was out there selling drugs with on the streets, all of them told him no. And see, this goes to what brothers like myself, Sean James, and many others who are right here on YouTube have been telling y'all about this modern Negro. Okay, this Baltimore brother that was interviewed by the Washington Post had a great idea and the right frame of mind to purchase this storefront property while the price is extremely low. But the rest of the Negroes that are around him ended up dragging him into the quagmire of apathy that surrounds the Negro landscape.
She a dude. She just hit you in your face. She a dude. That bitch good, nigga. Oh. Beat her motherfucking ass. She struck you a motherfucking nigga. Beat her motherfucking ass. She a
nigga. That nigga hurting himself.
You from New State.
Look, the main spot that this brother was looking to purchase had five rooms between both of the upstairs levels, and it just needed a little bit of furnishing. These spots could have easily been rented out to tenants or used as cheap housing by family and friends that could have worked a legitimate business out of that storefront. The Negro just don't get it, because the more legitimate storefronts, strip mall shops, apartments, and tenements you own would lessen the police targeting you, because then you can do what the foreigners and white folks that own these places do, which is hire the police to work security at your properties and places of business. Why do you think they don't go upside the heads of these foreigners? Because they step to the police officers and let them know that they have work for them. These foreigners and white folks that own and run these storefronts hire the cops, and if they don't pay them with cash, they give them free merchandise and meals on the house, so they in turn look out for them. And half these cops do moonlighting security at these places even when they are on duty, because all they got to do most of the time is just drive through with a squad car or do a quick foot patrol right near the business or apartment housing units that are being rented out. This is why they don't give the Chan family or any Chinese youngster any problems when they see them in the hood by their dry cleaners. This is why they don't bother Mr. or Mrs. Akbar or any Arab kids that they see near the gas stations they own. This is why they don't mess with Miss Yee or any of her grandkids that are close to the nail salon she owns, because they take a small percentage of the proceeds and pad the local policeman's pockets. And see, your typical foolish Negro that would challenge what I just told you will say, well, see, you insinuating that we got to bribe the police for them to stop brutalizing us. But they, like most, don't know anything about capitalism. It is a game of economic musical chairs. I just gave you the analogy when I mentioned all the foreign families that own all the storefronts, strip malls, and rental properties. Who is the only one who is left standing up with no businesses or property to speak of when the music is done playing and the cops roll through the neighborhood? That's us, yapping back and forth when the music stops and they tell our loitering asses to get moving or catch a bruising. That's us, walking around with sagging pants and glow-in-the-dark fluorescent color wigs like this sister that you see right here tossing rocks during the riot last April. Now, she's throwing rocks and expressing her anger and frustration, but she has a fresh weave on top of her head, which helped pay some of the officers that broke Freddie Gray's back. So who is the sellout and coon, black folks? And think about it. If you own some of those storefronts and control the flow of unlaundered, legitimate-made currency that comes through those areas, you can do your illegal dirt all day long without that much harassment from the local authorities. You might draw attention from a few alphabet gang organizations like the DEA, FBI, and others, but the local guys aren't going to pay that much attention because you're helping them pay bills and you're putting food in their stomach. And since I brought up the subject of illegal activity, and you pants-sagging clowns love to talk about how gangster you are, why don't you do what some of the Irish, Italian, Jewish, and Polish immigrants your dumbass keeps trying to emulate did by legitimizing some of your hustles and using the same police force that chases you around the neighborhood as a shield? See, most Negroes will try to tell you that we are always at the end of a nightstick, a baton, or getting showered with bullets just because we are black. But ask yourself a question. Why aren't that many Ethiopians and West Africans getting mollywopped and punished to the extent that many so-called African Americans are in the U.S.? Remember, they're just as black and sometimes way darker than us. But why are there fewer cases of them being brutalized and killed by the police like we saw with Amadou Diallo or Abner Louima, both of which took place in New York? Why so few cases compared to us so-called Afro-Americans? It's because they're smart enough to own businesses, restaurants, furniture stores, parking lots, etc., and pay the cops to look the other way so their fellow countrymen aren't harmed in any way. That's the logical thing to do. But you can't tell this Negro from America that, because you're still living off the backwards principle and creed of entitlement, which these liberals drafted up for us long ago. Instead of assessing this situation from a global perspective and seeing that everyone else seems to be purchasing everything around us so they can live comfortable lives and keep us at a position of marginalization as opposed to putting themselves in that boat, the Negro man and woman in the U.S. will counter it by saying, see, I object because my tax dollars pay for the police not to harass me. No, they don't, you imbecile. Especially after Uncle Sam rapes their paycheck just like he rapes everybody else's. Now, your pro-whack movement pseudo-black nationalist leaders will call me a coon for telling you this, but this is something that they know firsthand. They also know that you more than likely won't view this phenomenon from all angles because you're still under the influence of the can't we all just get along flavor Kool-Aid most black folks drank after the post-civil rights movement era, thinking that all the bigotry-enhanced physical assaults and beatdowns we took during chattel slavery and Jim Crow had an exclusive cutoff date to them, which is why every single year one of these highly publicized police brutality incidents takes place, there's some dumb Negro that says, I don't believe that in 2087 this is still happening to black people. Yeah, it is, and it's going to keep on happening in 2088 if you don't adopt a different way of thinking, dummy. Your pseudo-black nationalists won't tell you that you are mostly to blame for this continually happening because they want you to keep feeling sorry for yourself and attend more lectures and debates where they argue over whether or not a woman is God or which master teacher's philosophy is better to follow. But I'm here to tell you right now, black folks, that we don't need to attend a gazillion seminars, travel with a million other jugheads to commemorate the anniversary of a march that never led to mass black improvement, or study the teachings of some philosophical doctor with 10 degrees to find a solution to our problem. This brilliant brother from Baltimore that was interviewed in the December 9th edition of the Washington Post, who more than likely didn't even finish high school, just gave us the answer. And if you're wondering why I titled this thing Ballin' on Baltic Avenue, I did so as a way of saluting one of my grandfathers. See, long ago when I was a very little boy, he taught me how to play Monopoly. I was about 7 years old, and I was all geeked up racing around the board to buy Boardwalk and Park Place. And he said, go right on ahead. He let me do it and said, I'll just buy a Baltic, Mediterranean, Oriental, and all these other properties that you aren't even thinking about. So as the game went on, and I only owned Boardwalk, Park Place, and Pacific, I think, he had all the other properties, the railroads, the waterworks, the electric company, and a whole bunch of hotels and houses on all of them while I was looking silly. And I ended up having to sell what I owned and wait for that $200 paycheck once I passed go. Once it finally set in that I lost the game, he chuckled and told me, son, you gotta own what's in the ghetto before you walk around the block. And that lesson that my grandfather Dave, rest his soul, taught me still applies to this very day. Ownership is a universal language, no matter what culture or ethnicity you come from, because it regulates the sort of relationship you're going to have with most of the people around you.
And now, an exclusive first look at the upcoming documentary, 7 a.m.
Because true economic science is a branch of military science. War and money go hand in hand. Most wars are fights so people can make more money, and war is money. That means what? That the European American is not about to prepare black children to compete with his children for control of the economic sector. It's not going to happen. So if black people want this science, we got to teach it, we got to study it, and we're going to have to make some mistakes in perfecting it because we're still babies in the water of global economic commerce. As African people, we are financially illiterate. So we should not be surprised that we're so economically backward because we were never taught how to be economically forward. Our education in America has not provided or prepared us to be able to compete with Europeans economically. The historically black college was designed to do what? Teach you how to work for white people. Public schools, charter schools, parochial schools, independent schools. What is the purpose of education in America for black children right now? To teach them how to make a living working for white people. But I don't want the kids coming to my school to be going to class thinking that I'm learning this so I can go and get paid by a white person. They're going to be empowered to start their own business. When they leave that school, they're going to go into business. And why do we need our people to be self-sufficient? Because when you're not self-sufficient, you can't speak your mind. One of the biggest reasons why black people have been so cowardly in the post-civil rights movement, not standing up for ourselves, standing up for our children, standing up against police brutality, we're scared to lose our jobs. We have to work. We got kids. I can't talk about the racism on my job. I might lose it. So the reason why we're not speaking our mind is because we don't have economic freedom. As Mr. Garvey said, Marcus Garvey said, that a solid racial program must be built on a solid economic foundation. Show me your economic condition, and I'll show you your political condition. The political economy of the black community rests on the premise that because they do not make their own money, they are enslaved to Europeans. And as a result of that, they will never be able to do what needs to be done to carve out a future for their children, because the hand that pays is also the hand that rules them.
Okay, before we go to the phone lines today, jump off topic, which is we're doing a Spanish lesson. Social Security versus Family Social Capital Security. We'll be back cover that after the Spanish lesson. We'll get to the Spanish lesson in about 3 minutes.
African Americans post-emancipation were settling down in Houston in the what was known as the Fourth Ward, which is west of Houston's downtown area. My project was a study of African American church architecture. Several of the people that I conducted oral interviews with kept referring me back to the Texas room of the HMRC. The HMRC was quite useful in terms of providing information on what life was like for African Americans post-emancipation. And I was able to obtain pictures of what life was like back then, as well as in the early 19th century. We had doctors, we had dentists, we had religious leaders who were also professionals. We had teachers, a lot of teachers, male and female.
One prominent resident of Freedmanstown was Reverend Jack Yates.
He was a symbol of progress. This is someone who didn't have much to begin with, former slave, learned how to read, and he became a leader in the church. In 1891, in particular, he opened up Bethel Missionary Baptist Church in Freedmanstown. That church became an architectural symbol. It was one of the most significant pieces of architecture that later developed.
Freedmanstown was almost a city within a city, with its own business district and social structure, as Crystal Granger discovered when doing her research at the HMRC.
The Red Book of Houston by Emmett Scott is a collection of information, images of what life was like for African Americans post-emancipation. You can find out about the professions, the social histories, who the leaders were in the community, and basically just how the community developed and was a resource for other individuals who were coming from neighboring plantations. Also, in particular in Freedmanstown, there was a main street, Andrews Street, where you would find a lot of these professions. So everyone lived on this main street where a trolley ran through. So the development of Freedmanstown was somewhat of a model for developing a community in post-emancipation. City directories provided information on the individuals who lived in Houston. It stated their race, it stated where they lived, what kind of business they owned, and there were advertisements in the directories that gave you some insight about the business and their location.
A perfect example is a page in the 1886-87 directory, which lists people with these occupations: a railroad switchman, a clerk at Foley's Dry Goods Store, a sheet iron worker, a cotton clerk, a laborer, a teacher, a barber, and so on. The letter C in parentheses indicates that the person was colored or African American.
A lot of Houston's African American history is just fading away, and it was very important for me to try and get a glimpse of what life was like at that time.
Fourth Ward's historic Bethel Baptist Church was heavily damaged by fire in 2005.
Okay, a little bit of history there. Now we'll get off to our jump-off topic a little bit later. We're doing a Spanish lesson first. But that will be on Social Security versus family Social Security. Family Social Capital Security, but more on that later. Let's go to 773 Buenos Dias, Senorita.
Buenos Dias, mi amigo. ¿Cómo estás?
I need to answer back in Spanish. Good, bueno. Oh, no, bien.
So we had a phrase that goes.
Más o menos. Oh, I can't hear anything.
So the phrase goes.
We got to repeat that. Reba, repeat that because I couldn't hear you.
Que buen un trabajo hizo means what a good job you've done. You say que bueno, it's more like an expression. Que bueno. Or you said, no, I said, okay, that's good. That's what that means. No, you said yesterday, you said buen hecho. Hecho is the word that means to be made. It means made. Echar, to make. Hecho, I made. Buen hecho, it's an expression that means literally good job, because you offered that, remember? You offered buen hecho. Well, you offered that. It was just yesterday. So when you offer, was it yesterday? Whatever, look, vaguely, right? You said vaguely.
No,
like,
day before yesterday.
So it's interesting.
Because yesterday was Monday, so. Oh, what's today?
Right.
Tuesday?
So if,
no,
if,
it had to be
go,
Friday.
Right. Now, if we go with buen hecho, if you look inside of a clothing item with a tag, it's going to say hecho en Mexico. Hecho en Mexico. Made. Echar is a verb that means to make. Now, you got hacer. which is a verb that means to do. When we say, a que buen un trabajo hizo, it means done. So it's the verb that's conjugated to past tense, hizo. But what a good job you've done. So I wanted to just break that down for you for the grammar, for grammar purposes. Some things are expressions. So you said that you had heard that phrase before, buen hecho. And so where did you hear that phrase?
Well, I fiddle around with different languages, so somewhere in the mix I heard it.
Okay, yeah. So, and you do know it does mean the same thing. It's just an expression. Like, you know, I won't say slang. Some things are, you have Spanish slang. I've had a book. So at one point I was just buying all kinds of books. This is maybe 20 years ago or so. I was just like, handbook this, handbook that. One of my favorite ones was a Spanish slang. And then I found one with Spanish idiom. I found one with The Household Spanish was one of the first books that I bought from Barnes & Noble. Really, really great stuff because Household Spanish, you know, as I thumbed through it before I made the purchase, I'm like, And the subtitle was How to Communicate with Your Spanish Nanny or Spanish Worker.
I remember that video on YouTube.
No, not the same people. No, no.
Oh,
that
different
is not for
okay,
two. That's
different.
Not family friendly. That one.
No, that's not.
Fun.
That's for adults.
Pardon me?
That's for adults only.
It certainly is, yeah. So. And that was Spanish for your nanny or something like that, right? But then Household Spanish, subtitle, How to Communicate with Your Nanny, How to Communicate with Your Household Workers, whatever. So a lady had hired some help, and she couldn't communicate. She didn't want to let the lady go. She really liked her, but she figured out what she needed to say to be effective in communicating, which is how I teach Spanish. So if I say, let you say, buen hecho, and we're just in the kitchen and somebody bakes some brownies, they might think you made the brownies. You know, so it just depends on the context. When it comes down to any language, basically, what you are, what the conversation is about. And so that's when you use expressions and so forth. It's like, okay, buen hecho. Okay, like, the Bears won, you know, the game, last game. Buen hecho. Okay, good job. That's what's up. So, yeah, it's one thing about it just to become, use what you know and build on the conversation and take it from there.
Okay.
So, my friend, you want to speak to
my
baby? Yeah, baby.
Baby, mama.
Oh, here it is.
Feliz cumpleaños. Say happy birthday.
Happy birthday. You have two grandsons, right?
I do. Dos nietos. Two nietos. Two grandsons, yes. I'm the abuelita.
Now, I've heard of abuelo or abuela, which is grandmother, but I never heard the word you just pronounced.
An affectionate way. It's an affectionate way to say abuela, abuelita.
Right.
Because these are my grands.
Abuelita.
So my teenage, when they become teenagers, they may still call me abuelita. It's just an affectionate. So remember, Spanish, and I do encourage people that Spanish is a romance language. So you kind of just feel your way through what to say, when to say. Many things
right.
are general. Many things are general. However, if they're really close to me and they want to call me Because if they're having a conversation, they're going to say mi abuela. But if they're talking to a family member or just someone close to them, they're going to refer to me as abuelita. It's an affectionate way of saying abuela.
All right.
Mind you, I do learn a long way, and some of the Spanish with that, Brother L.A., I learned that from
and that's
native
reserved
Spanish
for. Yeah, that's reserved for, well, like your grandchildren, people, you know, closer to related people.
Are you researching?
No. I just made a comment. That was all.
So we can look it up. 123 Teach Me is another site that I use, 123 Teach Me / Spanish. I do not use Google. Google is not accurate. I don't use Google for this purpose because it's not accurate. It's actually a contribution site like Wikipedia. So some things may not be accurate, and we just don't want to encourage that. The others I refer because you can actually do comparison in the language. From
the 4-year-old question.
From a comparison in grammar.
Uh-huh. I got a question. Now, the grandson that I hear right now, how old is he?
There are two that are sitting next to me. Yaves, the Yaves.
So my question is,
Bonnie is three, and Elijah is one.
Okay, now 3 and 1. Okay, so. Normally, because you've gone through this three times, what is the normal age that they start talking? Well, like the first, you know, first word and then, you know, sentences, that type of stuff.
Because
he's communicating right now. He's communicating right now. I can't understand it, but he can understand it. But about what age? Like my first word was steak. I don't know how old I was. Maybe two. I don't know. But
okay. I don't know. I would say. I don't know, about 8 months. I don't know. My children were a little different because I've always acted like a speech therapist. I read to them while I was with child. My grandson, my oldest grandson, was counting up to 20. And his mom kept him away, being upset with my son. So he backtracked. He was counting up to 20 before he was actually one. And so some words, I would just let him feel the vibration of my lips. I would let him watch my mouth. I always say, mira la boca. Mira la boca. Uno. Dos. Tres. His younger brother normally chimes in. He's playing with my keys now. Yaves. So the thing is, he backtracked. She was complaining about his speech, but she was like, well, you know, I just wish his speech was more developed. Well, remember, he was with me every day. So you gotta consider, what are they getting, what are they learning every day? So as far as stages of development, eight to 12 months, I would say, yeah. Were you able to pull up that site? I just real quick, I wanted you to see 123 Teach Me. We have SpanishGICT.com, but 123 Teach Me is
right,
another.
Are you
123 Teach Me / Spanish.
What comes up? All right, hold on, let me put it in it. That has a domain name, like a .com.
123teachme.com / Spanish.
Okay.
No.
All right, let's see, .com. All right, one, two, three, teach me. Is that it? Hello?
123teachme.com/Spanish.
All right, I got 123teachme. All right, hold on me. 123teach, thumbs up again. 123teachme. 123spanish.com. Oh, 123learnspanish.com. That's it or not it? Okay. Reba, all I'm getting back is 123teachme.com. I put in 123spanish.com, and I'll try it again. Yeah, 123teachme. Well, hold on, wait. This could be it.
Well, I just sent you the link.
All right, it keeps popping back up. 123.
I just sent you the link. You see it?
Oh, wait a minute. I got to go to Clubhouse. I'm at Clubhouse WhatsApp. You said I don't have it on WhatsApp. I'm on there now.
Just tap on that, and
all right.
That more than likely will be it.
Okay. Did you send it through WhatsApp? Because I haven't got it through WhatsApp.
I did. What did you say? You saw 123teachme. That was it. You said you saw 123teachme.com.
Oh, I'm on that now. I'm on 123teachme right now. .com. I'm on that. Study Spanish for free. I'm on that site now. I got that.
So put your phrase in there. Whatever you want to learn.
Okay. Spanish sentence maker. Okay. I'll do something. Something.
So you put, you can put a phrase in there, a word. And SpanishJCT.com, I actually put full. I put full documents. What do you need?
All right, I'm on. Hey, 123, teach me. All right, start here, and let me put it in again. Oh, all right, no, that's not working.
What's going on? So some things have changed around, like Spanish VICT, it's, some things have changed too. Some things have changed around too, so.
Well, let me put on my phone. Okay.
But you're able to get the congregation. The link I sent you is
on it didn't come through on WhatsApp.
It's in
there,
but I'm
right now. So.
Oh.
All right, now I got it. Now I got it.
Yeah.
Now I
got
it. Okay.
It is in his sin.
Oh, right, no, well, that explains that.
You see the chart?
Wait, hold it. Now I got to get rid of this commercial that just popped up for us.
No, you can ignore the commercial and scroll up. So what good thing about this site is that I like the fact that you can print or download the conjugation verb charts, which is something that's for an advanced learner, or just if a person would want to familiarize themselves with it, that's fine. You don't want to get frustrated by trying to, you're not going to memorize. I don't encourage memorizing a whole bunch of stuff. Use what you need to use right now, what you'd like to learn, and then build on that. So if I say, que te gusta hacer, now we're sticking with the verb to do. I'm asking you, what would you like to do? What do you like
word.
To do? Because if you say would, it's another word. Que, so I said, do you have your notes? You have your notes out, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm said, on the 1, 2, 3 site right now.
H-A-C-E-R is the verb to do. H-A-C-E-R. H-A-C-E-R.
Yeah. All right. All right. H-A-C-E-R, what you gave me last week. Now, what I wrote down last week was done.
Okay. D-O-N-E. That's H-I-Z-O. Done is H-I-Z-O. Same verb. Conjugated. Some of the letters change. Well, most of them in this case, except the H. H-I-Z-O means done. But done is past tense of do.
All right, H-I-Z-O.
That means done.
Okay, done.
We have one more minute. I'd like to share this with you. Something
sure.
that
we
can
wait, before you go to H-A-C-E-R. H-A-C-E-R is. If H-I-Z-O is done, Hasar, that's wrong, H-A-C-E-R is that doesn't mean done as well, does it?
It means to do.
To do. All right. H-A-C-E-R, to do. H-I-Z-O, done.
Yeah, we were just breaking down the phrase, okay, bueno trabajo hizo, what a good job you've done. Buen hecho, if you look at the word buen, good, hecho, made. Good made, you know, so we just kind of don't want to always look at Spanish verbatim. Because verbs are in different places as well. So I wanted to break down the verb hacer and give you another phrase where it's used. So we'll just continue that on Thursday. And I did post on Facebook that we're doing the Speak Spanish. And so we'll be back on Thursday. So, you know, I just posted a note with the number that we could be on, you know, 10 o'clock. Ish within the 10 o'clock hour for the Speak Spanish. So I hope that you learn something new, which is the goal for every time, and then we build on what we know.
Build on what we know and use what we know.
Yeah, of course. Building on what you know, you're going to use it. So I just try to shorten it because a lot of times we're like, wait a minute. Wait, what did you say? So just if you learn something new, then use it. That's what will make it stick with you. It's just some of the things that I've done to help to learn to develop my level of fluency. And I'm still learning. Now we have the Venezuelans, and I'm noticing the different dialects. I got a call coming out. I got to take that call.
Okay.
I'll still be on the air, but I got to take this
right.
call, okay?
All right. Well, we'll be here. Okay.
By the time you met Blandón, how big were you getting? Like, how much were you buying on a regular basis?
Oh, no, maybe a couple pounds, 16 pounds maybe.
16 pounds.
Yeah, 8 pounds, something like that. Okay. At that time, pounds were going for 35. Thousand a pound, yeah.
By the time you met Blandón, how much cash did you have?
I don't know. I had a few hundred thousand.
A few hundred thousand. So you weren't a millionaire back then, but you were well off.
I was doing good.
You
yeah.
was doing good.
I was doing pretty good.
So how did the whole Blandón thing come together?
Well, see, we were still getting from Blandón, but we wasn't going directly to Blandón.
It was a middleman.
It was a middleman. So The only thing happened when we met him personally was that the middleman had got cut out, which dropped the price even more. But we were already getting it from Blandon, technically.
Technically.
Yeah.
You just weren't talking to him.
I just wasn't talking to him.
Okay. So how did you end up meeting him?
I bought him.
You bought him?
Mm-hmm.
So you basically bought your connect.
Yeah.
So you told your middleman, I'm going to give you...
$60,000.
$60,000, and you introduced me to your connect, and you can walk away with that $60,000.
Yep, and then Blandon paid $60,000 as well.
To meet you.
Yeah, to meet me.
So the connect got $120,000, mm-hmm, to essentially walk away from that part of the business?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, he got spooked, I heard. You know, somebody had got busted.
He was trying to get out of the game.
He was trying to get out of the game, so he felt, you know, he'd take $160,000, go back to Honduras, and live like a king.
$120,000. And that's what he did? He left?
I guess, yeah, for a while.
Okay. So now you're working with the connect. Blandon.
Yep.
How is that relationship different than your previous relationship?
We got a lot tighter, you know. Me and Blandon hung out a little bit together. You know, I would go over his house. The other guys were more meet on the street, switch cash for money, you know, money for drugs, and it's over. But me and Blandon, we kind of hung out. We talked about business. So we developed kind of what I thought was a friendship as well.
Okay. Now, Blandon is the one that actually took you to the next level.
Technically, yeah, and no, you know.
Explain.
I mean, we took each other to the next level.
Okay. I see what you're saying.
You know, I wasn't, I wasn't out here helpless and homeless. You know, when I met him, I had a few $100,000 and I had clientele. I knew the streets. You know, I knew all the shot callers from every hood in L.A. You know, so he helped, but you know, not by himself.
According to some articles I looked up. And you could tell me whether this is accurate or not. It said that you were making up to $3 million a day.
I've had days that I made $3 million.
You had a $3 million day?
Yeah.
Okay.
A few of them.
A few of them. Explain how you have a $3 million day.
Well, your big customers come through, a couple of them, and they drop off $200,000, $300,000. There were... three or four spots that I had in L.A. where guys just stood out on the street that would make $100,000 a day, each one.
Each one?
Yeah.
Now, this actually built up. I guess you had operations in 42 cities?
I don't know how many cities. I mean...
A lot of cities.
We had a lot of cities.
All throughout the country.
Yeah.
So explain to me, and... Okay.
You know, different people do their estimates and their calculations, yeah, and all
right,
that stuff. So,
and I guess the other thing is that you moved $900 million worth of cocaine.
Or more.
Or more. Which in today's dollars is the equivalent of $2.5 billion.
Yeah.
So you were moving.
You figure like this here. If you do 100 kilos in one day, that cocaine goes a lot of places. You know, a lot of people, they taking it, they putting it on airplanes, they moving it around. Now you're talking about you move 200 kilos in one day, or 250, you're talking about that's a lot of cocaine.
Okay. If you were to stack up 250 kilos right now, how big would it be? Would it cover this entire room?
No. 250 kilos is not that big. Maybe the size of that couch.
That's it?
Yeah.
And that's the equivalent of $3 million?
According to what price you're getting.
Yeah.
What time it is. You know, one time I paid as much as $48,000 for a kilo. So $3 million won't go for when you're buying them like that.
Right.
But if you're getting them for 10 a kilo, you can buy 300.
Okay.
So all that factors in, you know. And I, like I said, I paid as much as, I paid 3,200 for an ounce of cocaine. And if you add that up, you're talking about like $100,000 for 1 kilo. But for the whole kilo, I paid $48,000 cash for one. And I've also bought them for $9,500.
Right.
As low as $9,500.
So how were you actually getting this much cocaine on a regular basis? Were you getting it once a week, every day?
100 keys every day.
You were getting 100 kilos years. Every day?
My last 2 years, yeah, every day.
Every single day?
Oh, absolutely.
Can you say how you were actually getting it?
In the trunk of cars.
So Blandone would basically
set up...
You'd
have a driver to pull up wherever I wanted it dropped off, and they'd pull it there and leave the keys under the floor mat. My guys would get in it and take it to where I wanted it.
Okay. How big was your actual crew in terms of people that answer directly to you? Obviously, when you're talking about hundreds of kilos, it's going all over the world, and there's all types of people.
I understand what you're saying. Yeah. Like, if you see the special they did on CBS called Elliot Gang Godfathers, I think they had me surrounded by about 25 guys,
okay,
30 guys who were like my, they call lieutenants.
Okay.
But it varied from time to time, you know. Guys quit, get fired, you know.
Get busted.
Get busted, which was rare.
Why was it rare?
I taught my guys how to sell and how to avoid the law.
Okay.
So they were pretty good at avoiding the law.
How did you really manage a crew like this? Because when you talk about money, this much money, you're talking about drugs, you're talking about women, you're talking about violence, you're talking about gangs. And then you're also talking about law enforcement. How do you really manage a crew of this many people and keep it from just falling apart in an afternoon, which happens all the time?
The first thing you got to do, you have to really be humble in yourself and always look at situations from the other person's point of view. That's one of the things that I do. I always try to see your point of view first, because I know to you, the most important thing is your point of view. You don't care about my point of view, but your point of view is always important. So I usually go with your point of view, and most of the time is, how can I get food, shelter, and clothes?
Okay.
Those are motivating, really, really high motivating factors. So if you can provide those to most people, they'll give you their attention. I mean, you're going to run into some, though. That's, you know, you can give them that, and they still going to be, what did we call it earlier? We were talking about it earlier. I forgot what it was, but we were talking about shady or something like that.
Yeah.
Or shysty or something we called it. Yeah. So no matter what you do, you still can run into those type of people. But, you know, you just be able to roll past it.
Okay. So you had 25 people, roughly. Allegedly,
yeah.
Moving up to $3 million a day in product.
Some days.
On some days.
And there'd be days where there's $2
million. Yeah.
$1.5 million.
Okay.
$1.2 million.
They don't really portray Chicago like that. And he did a lot of funny shit with it, man. And it just made me laugh at certain moments. And I think that wasn't smart to do it like that.
We were sitting in, and like, you know, the energy just started getting thick between us. And then I was getting aggravated. He was like, oh, I think we should leave. And I was like, yeah, I think you should leave. So I was like, get the fuck out of here. You know what I mean?
I got in a huge tax situation in 2008 because my divorce was in 2005 and my accountant had gotten in cahoots, and next thing you know, my accountant died.
I used to spend the night in hotel parking lots. What was I going to do? I didn't have nowhere to stay, so I lived in the car. I had $35. And I said, come on, God, man, I've been trying to make this dream come true. You done left me out here like this. And I was crying so hard that he just said, I didn't like hear a voice or nothing, but he spoke to me. And however, he said, if you get up, I'm going to take you places you ain't never been. Now, I was finna quit. So I said, skip it. I'm going to quit anyway. So I got in my car. I went to a payphone, and I was going to call my dad. You remember back in the day where you could punch in a code and call your answering machine and get your messages? So I called, and I punched in the code, and the said, doop. He said, hey, Steve, this is Chuck Sutton with Showtime at the Apollo. We saw a tape of you. You're very funny. If you could get here Sunday night, we'd love to put you on television. Call me back. Let me know if you can make it. So I hung the phone up. I'm crushed because my whole dream of being on TV, and I couldn't get to New York. I got $35. How am I going to get to New York? I can't make it. So I'm standing there at the phone booth and tears just coming down my face. I said, God, so that must be a sign for me to go home. Because this is it. I ain't even got the money to go to the Apollo. My whole thing, wanting to be on TV, I couldn't even make the dream come true. This is the most messed up moment. And so I said, man, let me call this dude back and see if he said this Sunday. Because maybe he said next Sunday and I could hustle up a little bit of money or something. I don't know what I'm going to do, but let me just call him back. So I call him back. Steve, this is Chuck Sutton, Showtime at the Apollo. We saw a tape of yours. You're very, very funny. Look, we have an opening Sunday night at Showtime at the Apollo. If you can make it, we'd love to put you on TV. I said, it's this Sunday. Before I hit the button, I heard, doop, you have another message. Now, it wasn't there before. So I punched my code in. I listened to the second message. It says, Steve Harvey, this is Tom Sober from the Comedy Caravan. This is a Thursday. He said, I have a gig in Jacksonville, Florida on Friday night that pays $150. If you can get there Friday night, you'll make $150. So I called him back. And I said, hey, Tom, did you get a gig away? He said, no, it's still available. He said, can you get there? I said, I'm in Pensacola, Florida. I'm 3.5 hours away. So I drive to Jacksonville, Florida. And that night, I made the 150. The club owner said, man, you're funnier than the guy we hired. If you stay tomorrow night, I'm going to give you another $150. So now I got $300 now. So I get on the phone, I call Chuck Sutton, I say, hey man, is the gig still available at Showtime at the Apollo? He said, yeah, we got one opening left. I said, I'll be there. So I call Eastern Airlines, who used to be open back then. They had a special for $99 going from Jacksonville, Florida to New York round trip. So I parked my car at the airport. I got it. Got on a plane, flew. Everything I had was in two bags. Got to the Apollo. I said, hey, man, I'm here. I got there at 11 o'clock in the morning. He said, you can't stay here because you don't come on to the late show tonight. I said, man, I ain't got nowhere to go. I said, if you just let me stay in this building, man, I ain't gonna move around nothing. I ain't got nowhere to go. I'm in Harlem. I can't go back out here. I got these two bags. I got victim wrote all over me, man. So he said, all right, if you go upstairs, don't come down. So he put me in a dressing room on the 6th floor. So that's where all the comedians were. So I stayed up there. I got hungry around 3 o'clock, man. I couldn't take it no more. So I went back downstairs, a dude named Alton Liston. I said, hey, man. He said, man, I thought I told you don't come down them damn steps. I said, hey, man, I'm just hungry, man. I said, let me go to that KFC I saw on the corner. Just let me get some chicken. I'll come right back. He said, man, if you ain't back in 20 minutes, you ain't getting in this building. So I went, bought me some chicken, came back. So the comedians started coming in the building. They started coming up on the 6th floor. So I meet this guy named D.L. Hughley. I introduce myself. He introduced himself. I'm sitting there. Another guy come in named Dwayne Johnson. Then this other dude walked in named Jamie Foxx. And I introduced myself. We don't know each other. Ain't none of us famous. It's 1991, man. They gave everybody the lineup. I was on the last show of the night. I don't go on to 11 at night. I'd have had this four pieces of chicken. I'm starving, man. That chicken done wore off. I'm nervous, man. I'm about to throw up. D.L. Hughley went downstairs. D.L. Hughley got booed off. Dwayne Johnson got booed off. Jamie Foxx went down there and got booed. They booed Jamie, then Jamie started singing. And then they started clapping. And Jamie had their ass, then he went back to them jokes, and they got his ass. So I'm walking down the steps, and I see Jamie sitting on the steps. I said, hey, man, hang in there. He said, man, that ain't never happened to me before, man. This is crazy. This is Jamie Foxx, man, one of the most talented people in all of comedy. And now, you don't even know how nervous I am, man. I can't even. My breathing is shot because these dudes been booed. So I walk out. I had wrote this joke. Mike Tyson had got in a fight in Harlem with this heavyweight named Mitch Green. Mike Tyson had hit the dude in the eye in the store. Now, he was on the news. His eye was swollen. So the joke I wrote was, they was interviewing Mitch Green, and he was telling everybody what happened, but his eye took over the interview. And I wrote this joke that his eye started talking and was just, I tell you what happened. The heavyweight champ's fist is coming towards my face. I just said, Lord, Lord, Lord. And I wrote this whole joke about this dude's eyeball talking. And when the punch came, and all this here, the Apollo, man, they went crazy. They lost their mind. I got a standing ovation, man. I walked off stage, man, just started crying. I couldn't believe it. They paid me. I made $750 for being on TV for one night. I had never made $750 telling jokes in one night. And so that was my first television appearance. A couple weeks later, Sinbad was the host of the show. He got this job on Different World. And so he quit. And so Mark Curry became the host. And then Mark Curry got hanging with Mr. Cooper. And he quit. And they came to me and said, would you come back to New York and host Amateur Night for us to just try you out? Oh, ain't no problem. And so I went to New York. I hosted Amateur Night. And I was killing. But every time we went to commercial break, I was supposed to let the warm-up act take over like Ruben does. But I knew not to let the warm-up act do that because he would change the attitude of the crowd because Apollo was a wild place. So I stayed out there. I did the warm-up and the hosting. And I created a bond with that audience. And that's how I got on TV. It was my very first TV show. I hosted Showtime at Apollo. I ended up being the longest-running host in the history of Showtime. I did that show for 8 years. Nobody ever did it for 8 years. And that was my turn back moment. See, in your life, everybody has a turn back moment. You have a moment where you can go forward or you can give up. But the thing you have to keep in mind before you give up is that if you give up, the guarantee is it will never happen. That's the guarantee of quitting. That it will never happen, no way under the sun. The only way the possibility remains that it can happen is if you never give up, no matter what. Because God is always coming. He's never too late. At your worst moment, look, man, when they told me I had to be in New York, I saw no way I could get there. But that God, though, he make the phone ring. I end up in Florida, I make $300. Then I go to New York, I make $750. Almost got $1,000 out of nowhere. That's what happened to me. That was my my moment of never giving up, that's when I first learned that faith was everything, that you have to remain faithful.
So when people try to figure out how to make $1 million, they have no idea how daunting that is. Because if you know how to make $1 million, you go make it tomorrow. But since you can't figure out how to $1 million idea, you go somewhere and sit down. That's the wrong approach. If you apply your gift, your God-given gift that he gave you, you have millions already at your disposal. If you break it down inch by inch into things of sense for the 10-by-10 theory, which is very simple. You don't need $1 million idea. You need a $10 idea. You need something that you do, your gift that God gave you, to make $10. That's all you got to be able to know. I don't care if it's cutting hair, cutting somebody's grass, washing somebody's car. I don't care if it's mowing somebody's lawn. I don't care if it's driving people to their destinations. I don't care if it's babysitting. I don't care if it's baking cookies or pie. You have some braiding somebody's hair. You have something that you can do so well that someone will give you $10 for it. Write my paper for me. Do this for me. Somebody give you $10 for it. Once they give you $10, all you got to do is whatever you did to get that 10, do it 10 more times. You now, my friend, have $100. You have $100 simply because you took a $10 idea and you did it 10 times. Well, guess what? If you take that $100 that you made since you've done it 10 times and you do it 10 more times, I got news for you, my friend. You now have $1,000. $1,000, you make $1,000. Guess what all you got to do? You got to multiply that effort again. Do whatever you did to do $1,000, do it 10 more times. My friend, you now have $10,000. You got $10,000 now. Imagine if you was making an extra $10,000 a month. Just imagine if you was making an extra $10,000 a month. That's $120,000 a year. But I got news for you, my friend. Whatever you did, whatever it took to make yourself $10,000, all you got to do is do it 10 more times. 10 more times, my friend. You now have $100,000. I got news for you now. If you can make $100,000, you're just a step away from being a millionaire, man. Because now you hire a few more people to help you out, that you can do portions of what you do, so you can duplicate that effort. And one more time, just one more time, do it 10 times. Man, that sounds hard. It is hard. But what else you got to do? What, you going to stop at the 100,000? All you got to do is duplicate your efforts by 10. You duplicate your efforts by 10, 10 times 100,000. Welcome to the club, my friends. You are now a millionaire. Congratulations. You became a millionaire with a $10 idea. So stop bogging yourself down trying to figure out how to make a million. Do what you can do to make $10. And then do the 10-by-10 theory. Inch by inch, anything's a cinch. Now, here's the joyful part. Along the way, when you was down here making $20,000, but you did right here, and now all of a sudden you're making $30,000. Now you're making $100,000. But on the way to duplicating that times 10, you may stop along in here at $250,000. You can make it $250,000 a year. That's way better than that $20,000 you had when you started. So there's joy in the process. Your life is actually a lot richer at $250,000. It'll become even more richer at $500,000. It becomes even richer than that at $750,000, $750,000. If you don't get to the million, man, you're going to trip because you're making $900,000 a year? No, you're going to be happy. What, you don't make the million, so you only make $700,000 a year? You can't find happiness in $7,000? Something wrong with you, man. There's joy in the process. That's how you make $1 million.
Reba, are you there?
Yes, sir. I am here.
Okay.
But I just said it's still on. Yeah, Sylvia McGee, just share with me. She is she's the daughter. There's generations of dancers, dance teams. The current dance team is called BLT, Bringing Out Talents, the dance team. They actually, that's my friend Sylvia's daughter. And Sylvia's nephew is in the tots that are Bringing Out Talent, BLT. So Sylvia actually is the daughter of a young lady who founded a dance group. And so it's from her grandmother's, her mother's dance team to her. She passed it on to her daughter. And then there's a grandchild that's dancing. So I think that it's really good to be active. And I just told Stevie to call in, too, by the way. So we'll see if she's gotten me call numbers.
And she hasn't called. Well, if she's there, press 1. I don't see her on the board, so but press 1.
Her grandson. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Brother LA?
Yeah, I can hear you. I can hear you clear. Can you hear me?
Oh, sorry about that.
Yeah, I can hear you.
Spanish with me. He started Spanish with me a couple of weeks ago. And then they had the parade. So we got to get him back online with me. We were doing virtual sessions. Really, really smart kid. Baby J, we call him.
Okay. All right. Well, tonight I believe there's the loan presidential debate will happen tonight. Well, not the loan, but the one between Harris and Trump. I understand that.
Okay. Okay.
And I imagine that will, in real time, they'll have an interpreter for people who speak Spanish. Carrie probably on Telemundo or Univision. Oh, wait a minute. I'm looking that up now. All right, now, when you were learning, were you watching Spanish movies? Or movies in Spanish? Hello? Okay, I can't. Hello?
Yeah.
Yeah,
Brother,
when
you
were learning Spanish, yeah, I can hear you. Now, do you watch movies in Spanish?
I have. I don't have cable right now, so right now I just watch YouTube and things. Unless my son's put a movie on for me. So I got DVDs. So I don't have a cable or anything. A cable internet. I used to watch full movies in Spanish. I think one was called Estrella, Stars.
Okay.
That's cool.
All right. Any other announcements before we shut down for today? Hello?
Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah, any other announcements before we sign off?
No, not at this time.
Okay. All right, then on that note, hasta luego.
Hasta luego.